Hey, all you listeners out there in Dollar Bin listener land, this is Adam of the Dollar Bin. Feels like I've been saying that quite a bit lately, but it need be said. What you're about to listen to is part one of the Dollar Bin Mike Carey interview. The folks interviewing Mike Carey are Joel and myself. Before we get into that, I do have a couple quick Dollar Bin announcements, notes to make. First is we will be recording the Dollar Bin Awards Best of 2010 this weekend, so make sure you get your votes in before that. It's open voting, so you can put whoever you want. You can fill in whichever categories you want. The only thing required is name. You know, we're giving away some pretty cool stuff to people who participate in the Dollar Bin voting. So we're recording the Best of show this weekend. What you're about to listen to is part one of the Mike Carey interview. Next Wednesday, we are going to be posting the Dollar Bin Awards, Best of 2010. The Wednesday after that, we will be posting the part two of the Mike Carey interview, so be on the lookout for that. Now, that being said, the entire uncut Mike Carey interview is in the Dollar Bin members section, along with all other interviews that we record the evening that they're recorded, get posted up in there, as well as outtakes from any of the shows, and all of the Dollar Bin archives, including interviews, panels, and shows, which have passed the one-year expiration date. We're also doing a bunch of giveaways, monthly giveaways for that, for people who sign up for the Dollar Bin membership. It helps us pay for costs of this kind of this lovely podcast that we bring to you and all these awesome interviews that we can supply. That's it for Dollar Bin news, but before we get into the interview with Mike Carey, I have one more quick announcement, and that is the Dollar Bin has a sponsor to add to their list, and that sponsor is Westfield Comics. Westfield Comics was started in 1979, and they have been catering to the needs of comic fans for over three decades with an online comic shop and two Madison retail stores. It prides itself on being the industry's premier purveyor of comic books and graphic novels, offering an experience online that both mimics and improves upon the local comic book store experience, and ensuring that every interaction with Westfield makes customers feel that they are part of something special and fun. They are a better comic shop delivered. So if you're interested in giving them a look, that is westfieldcomics.com. Let's get on to the interview.
Adam, I'm going to let you start out today since this one's for you, buddy.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Joel for putting this together, Mike. He's really good at doing this, and I appreciate it very much. I actually got to see you briefly up at New York Comic Con, and right. I saw you up on the Vertigo panel. I don't know if you were at a table or anything at that show, though, were you?
I did signings at both the DC and Marvel booths, but they were kind of arranged at the last moment, so they weren't particularly well publicized.
I'm really excited because, you know, I got to go to that Vertigo panel. I had a blast at it. Like I said, I didn't get a chance to talk to you, so this is a great opportunity for me, and I look forward to seeing what we can turn this into. Joel, I mean, you do your thing, kind of. We have this thing where Joel is very structured, and Joel has a great list of questions, and I am very aloof and just kind of fly by things. So I'm going to go ahead and just let Joel hand it off for now so he can do the structured thing, and I'll color on in.
Okay.
Mike, let me ask you. You were born and raised in the UK. What was the first comic that you remember reading initially?
Well, the first comic I ever read, it was called Wham. It lasted very, very briefly between 1962 and 1964. That's between, I was like 3 to 5 years old at that time. It was the work of a British genius, Leo Baxendale. I don't think he's traveled. I don't think any of his work ever made it to the States. It was a humor comic for little kids. The first American comic I ever read was a Fantastic Four. It was a British reprint of a Fantastic Four annual quite early on in the run. It was still Stan and Jack. It was the issue where Reed Richards is trapped in the negative zone and the rest of the FF send Triton of the Inhumans to rescue him.
Did you read a lot of American comics, or was it more British growing up?
Well, I kind of got weaned from British onto American. You know, when I was very young, I read mostly British because one thing Britain did very well in those days was funny books for little kids. But we didn't have a tradition of of superhero books, of adventure books for older children. So once I discovered Fantastic Four and then the X-Men, there was no turning back. You know, it was kind of like that was my thing from then on. I have to admit, I say X-Men and Fantastic Four, and then they were the first two American comics that I got really interested in. But there was definitely a period when it was mainly DC that I would read, because DC stories tended to be complete in one issue. And Marvel stories tended to run over two or three issues, and there would often be cliffhangers. And it was almost impossible in the UK at that time to guarantee that you would get the next issue. You'd have to go from one store to another and just keep on saying, "Do you have Daredevil 13? Do you have this?" Whereas with DC, you would at least get the resolution.
Now, I've heard it said that American comics tend to be pretty good with the story, but British comics are always a lot better with the dialogue and the motivation, stuff like that. Did you find that, being exposed to both at the same time?
No, I don't think it's that straightforward. I mean, I think it was more the age thing. I mean, as I say, we didn't do superhero books. We did war stories. There was this thing called the Commando Picture Library, which was lots and lots of stories about soldiers in the Second World War, and occasionally you'd get First World War or Boer War or maybe even sort of old stuff like Roman legions or whatever. And actually the dialogue was pretty generic for the most part. And as opposed to American books of that period, the creators were never credited. You never got to find out who was writing or drawing those books, so you could never follow your favorite creators. I think the first comic creator whose style I was aware of as a style was this British guy, Baxendale, Leo Baxendale, who tended to do very, very, very detailed rendering in panels. Every panel would have like five or six different little jokes in the background, a phenomenal amount of detail. And then after him, I guess, Jack Kirby. I like this style of storytelling. I like that panel. I like that way of drawing these people. I was probably much less aware of dialogue in those days than I am now.
Going through and reading all these comics, when did you decide that writing was something that you wanted to give a shot? Was it early on? Was it when you were a teacher? When did it kind of hit you?
I always wrote for fun, but I tended to write, although I read comics, I tended to write prose. I wrote short stories, I wrote novels, and then there was a period when I was writing a lot of comics journalism, all unpaid for amateur publications, fanzines. I wrote reviews, occasionally I'd write longer articles, and then, but by pure chance, there was this British fanzine, this British comics magazine called The Fantasy Advertiser, and the guy who was editing there began to edit a line of British indie comic books, and I pitched him some stuff. It just seemed like a natural progression from what I was already doing. I had no idea how you wrote a comic. I'd never seen a comic script at that time. And so somebody said, you probably ought to look at a comic script. And I can remember picking up the Watchmen trade, which had an Alan Moore script in the back. It was the complete script for issue one of Watchmen. So I thought, oh, okay, so that's how it's done. So all of my comic scripts back then were immensely long and precise in the same way that Alan Moore's are, because I thought that was the only way there was to do it. And I gradually sort of developed into a looser, sparser style.
We talk about the British invasion of music in the 60s, but comics kind of had its own British invasion in the 80s with Moore and Gaiman and Morrison coming over. Other than Moore, which seems like he had a fairly large influence on you, how were you influenced by the guys who came before you as part of the British invasion?
I think of those three, I mean, they were all huge influences on me. And they did completely revolutionize comic storytelling. It has to be said. The stuff that they were writing, I was completely addicted to. Of the three, probably Neil Gaiman was the biggest influence on the way I tell stories. In some ways, what Gaiman did in Sandman was a natural continuation of what Alan Moore was already doing in Swamp Thing. It felt very fresh and very revolutionary. This whole business of having long arcs and then self-contained one-off stories and alternating between those two, and using the one-off stories to to feed back into the main narrative in unexpected ways, to follow the fortunes of minor characters, to introduce new characters, or just to show the same events from a different point of view. That was an amazing revelation to me, the idea that a comic could do that. And in Lucifer, I was, initially, I was just channeling Neil Gaiman. I was just basically applying all of those lessons. And it took me a while, I think, to develop my own voice, because he was such a strong influence on me.
You know, you beat me to that, Mike. I was about to say, it really seemed like you continued that exact same story structure into Lucifer. It was almost a seamless transition from his run to yours.
And I was, I was intentionally going for that to some extent. I wanted it to feel like a continuation of Sandman, which is a pretty ambitious project. But, that was my dream book. The idea of writing another story in that continuum, taking forward the fortunes of those characters, it was such an amazing thing to be allowed to do.
Let me ask you a little bit more about Lucifer then. With Neil Gaiman, you said that he influenced you greatly. How intimidating was that to get tapped to write Lucifer, kind of a continuation of his stuff? Was it something that you just thought, I don't even want to touch because I like what Neil did so much? Or
no, I was itching to do it. I never had any sort of moments of, can I possibly do this? Am I taking on an impossible task? I never felt the scale of it. I just got stuck in because I what Gaiman had done, if you think about it, with Sandman, was he'd created a mythology that swallowed all other mythologies. He'd created this stage on which angels from the Judeo-Christian tradition could talk to Japanese storm gods, could talk to Navajo tribal deities, and it would all make sense. You could put these folkloric and mythological and religious figures into the same context, and it all made sense. And so I was just aching to be able to do that, to be able to use those freedoms, to use that scope. Lucifer was a 7-year head trip. It was just so much fun to do, especially, after issue 5, when Peter Gross comes on board, and suddenly I've got this artist who can take anything I throw at him and turn it into gold. That was a real turning point.
When you started up on Lucifer, did you contact Neil Gaiman? Did you seek his advice, say, is it okay if I do this? Is there anything I shouldn't do with the character? Or did you just, I'm going to do my own thing?
Oh, no, Neil was on board as a script consultant for the whole of the run. But he was very active to begin with. When I put the pitch together, there was a lot of conversation between me and Neil and Shelley, who was the editor on the book, and Karen Berger, the Vertigo Group editor. And Neil was very, very generous with his time, with his advice, with his opinions. I can only once ever, in the whole of the time that I talked to him, I can only remember him ever saying no to me once, and that was about certain aspects of the dialogue between Death and Lucifer in around about issue 27 of the monthly run, when I had Death talking as though she has a realm, as though she has a realm of the dead, in the same way that, Lucifer has hell or Morpheus has the dreaming. And Neil said, no, we haven't set her up in that way, so it doesn't make sense in terms of the way I envisage the character. But everything else, he would just say, well, if I was doing it, I would think about these factors, or that sounds cool, but I might steer clear of this. He was just brilliant to work with. He was such a... He was so patient. He was so generous. He was just... I was going to say a perfect collaborator, but it's not like we were collaborating. He was giving me the benefit of his experience and of his sort of overview of the franchise, and asking nothing in return. I'm still very, very grateful to him for that.
When you did the original pitch for Lucifer, did you have the whole thing plotted out? You're not going to have the whole thing, but did you know how this was going to end and where the major beats were going to be?
What I pitched was the first 3 years in a fair amount of detail, right up to the end of The Divine Comedy, the point where Lucifer and Amenadiel fight in hell. I had that very clear in my mind. And the Morningstar arc, the idea that sooner or later the war between heaven and hell would be fought again, and Lucifer would be on the wrong side, that Lucifer would actually end up defending heaven. So it was that first 3 years, and then jump forward to around about issue 60, and that's where the climax will come. What happened in between, we just made up, really. We had a vague idea of where we were going, and an awful lot of things just happened because they happened, because we were following this character or this arc. So it was a mixture of planning and serendipity.
Now, you kind of had the rare opportunity in Lucifer to tell your story and then get out. And nobody continued it. You got to tell a beginning, a middle, and end, which is really kind of rare for comics. Robinson was Starman, Gaiman with Sandman. Are you glad that they didn't really continue it past when you finished up? Or do you think there's still more stories that you could have told or that could have been told with the character?
I'm very glad that Vertigo allowed us to do what we did, and I think it's a great strength of Vertigo that they have this concept of the story arc, which belongs to the creators, and they allow the book to reach its natural conclusion and then stop. And they've done that time and again. You know, with Preacher, with Why the Last Man, with Sandman, obviously. It does seem to be, you know, a core part of the way Vertigo works. Do I think there are still more stories to tell? Yes. Probably not Lucifer's story, though. I mean, I think there are stories that spring naturally out of his story. I would not want to go back and show where Lucifer is now. The last image we have of him, where he flies into the void, and we don't know whether he survives that or not. That's exactly where I wanted to end it. But I would love to go back to Gaudium and Spera. I would love to go back to Mezzakine, to Joel Presto, to Elaine, and see what those characters are doing now.
Have they ever come back to you and asked you to do anything like that?
No, only this once, you know, when I did the little tiny Gaudium story for the House of Mystery annual. That was the only time we've done it. That was a lot of fun, you know, just hooking up with Peter again and doing a little self-contained Gaudium story. We did talk once about a Mezzakine miniseries, a four-parter, but it was very much tied to the events of the book at that time. It was around about second year of the book, end of the second year of the book, when Dalliance with the Damned was happening in the main book. I pitched this idea, which was, let's look at Mezzakine in hell, Mezzakine assembling the Lilim and leading them out of hell. We got quite a long way on with the planning of that, but it, for various reasons, it didn't come together and never happened.
There's only been a few instances where the bad guy gets his own book. I know the Joker had it at one point, Doom, and Lucifer. How do you get into the headspace of a character like that? Was it easy? Was it hard for you to do? Initially?
It was a challenge because we talked an awful lot before I ever put pen to paper. We talked about how do you tell stories with... It wasn't even so much the fact of Lucifer being the bad guy or being an evil character. It's the fact that he's functionally omnipotent. Mm-hmm. You know, there's almost nothing he can't do, and there's almost nothing that can ever be a threat to him. So how do you put a character like that into a narrative where it seems on the face of it there can never be anything at stake for him? He can't lose. And so, yeah, we set ourselves some ground rules. You know, we almost never put Lucifer directly into a fight. Yeah, there are exceptions when he seems to be powerless and he fights Fenris and the duel with Amenadiel. But most of the time, you don't see Lucifer rolling his sleeves up and wading in and sort of getting down and dirty. He's more of a catalyst for other people's stories. And I think that was true of Morpheus as well. You know, most of the Sandman arcs after the first couple did not have Morpheus as the protagonist. They had other people as the protagonist, and Morpheus coming in at a crucial point, either to set the ball rolling or to provide a resolution or to twist the plot and turn it in a different direction. So I think the hardest part was just kind of like defining the ground rules, what you can and can't do with this character. The way we portray Lucifer, he's not really evil. He's beyond evil. He's the complete incarnation of selfishness. You know, he's someone who follows his own agenda to the point where nobody else is real to him except insofar as they help or hinder his plans. You know, he has zero concern for anybody else. It's sort of pursuing that logic, I guess, that terrifying logic. And there is a sense in which that's a part of the basic human equipment. There are times in our lives when it is easy to see somebody else as just an instrument, to see somebody else as just a tool or as, you know, an impediment in your way, and you just want to push them out of your way. And Lucifer represents that logic, but taken to its nth degree, I guess.
If you look at the bulk of the work that you've done, Hellblazer, Lucifer, Crossing Midnight, even Felix Caster, I don't know if occult is the right word, but you seem to be drawn towards this area, the supernatural. What is it about the supernatural that keeps bringing you back to it?
That's a good question, and I'm afraid I don't have a good answer. it's true. 99% of everything I've written has some kind of fantastic element. I frequently have this weird argument with my wife's stepfather, my stepfather-in-law. He dutifully reads everything I write, and he hates every word of it. he he reads it because I write it. But his position is a story isn't worth anything if it's not believable. So any story with magic or any story with science fictional elements, anything speculative, is rubbish to him because it's not believable. You can't suspend your disbelief and get into the story. And I kind of covered it from the opposite point of view. You know, saying that you only like realistic stories is saying you only like, it's like saying you only eat vanilla ice cream. There's a million other flavors out there. There's a million other angles to reality that you can come in or go out on. And I love that freedom. I love that kind of like three-dimensionality, I guess. I love being able to go beyond cause and effect, to go beyond realism into other realms. And I actually feel constrained a lot of the time if I try to write realistic stuff. Having said that, I've just finished a completely realistic thriller, which I really enjoyed writing. That was a change.
Let me cycle back to Lucifer for just another second. Was that your first real big splash in the U.S., or had you done something before that?
It was my break into the American mainstream. I'd done a fair bit of American work before that, but it was all for smaller publishers. You remember Malibu?
Yes.
Yes.
I did a couple of things for Malibu, not for the Ultraverse, which is their big superhero imprint, but they had a much smaller imprint called Rocket Comics, which was stories starring famous rock stars. So I did an Ozzy Osbourne book for them, and I did a Pantera book for them. And then
somehow doing Ozzy seems appropriate, considering what else you've written.
I'm looking that up now.
That was a strange gig. But through that, I met a bunch of guys at Caliber Comics. Mm-hmm. So I did I did a book called Inferno for Caliber, which was kind of Hellblazer-esque. And I did an adaptation of Dr. Faustus for them, and I did some short stories for Negative Burn. And everything I did for Caliber, I would send a copy to Elisa Quitney, who was the editor on Sandman, with a begging letter saying, I would love to write for Vertigo. Please let me write for Vertigo. And then the day came when she wrote back to me, and kind of everything else kind of followed from that, really.
Was Lucifer when you first worked with Peter Gross?
Yes. Yes, it was. I mean, I'd seen his stuff, both as writer and artist, on Books of Magic, and admired it. What happened with Lucifer was an incredible, a weird, serendipitous thing, which we couldn't have predicted. Because we initially, as you know, we went forward with a completely different art team, which was Chris Weston as penciler, and James Hodgkins as inker. And in the course of that first arc, the first three issues, they fell out. They had a huge argument, and they ended up briefly hating each other and threatening to kill each other. There's a big, big, violent exchange of opinions, and they both walked away from the book. Well, Chris walked away from the book, and then James backed away too. And we thought we were dead at that point. You know, you're only three issues into the monthly, and you've lost your art team. It's a very, very bad omen, because you have to have a complete change of look, complete change of texture, and you're quite likely to shake loose a big chunk of your audience at that point. But it just happened to coincide with the end of Books of Magic, and Peter was free. Shelley approached him and said, you know, would you be interested in doing this? And Peter said, categorical, no. You know, he'd just come off a big fantasy book, which he'd been drawing for many years and writing and drawing for some. And he just wasn't, you know, he wasn't interested in doing more of the same. But she sent him the script for issue 5, and he liked it enough to say, yeah, okay, I'll give this a try. And that was, so what could have been our undoing was actually huge good fortune.
What did Peter bring to the book that the original art team didn't have? What gelled with Peter with you?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm going to have to try and be tactful, because I am a huge admirer of Chris Weston's work. I think Chris is amazing. You know, he's amazing on Invisibles, on The Filth. He's done such spectacular work for DC and Vertigo over the years. Yeah, I think he was probably not the right fit for Lucifer, because you know how his work is incredibly fully realized, incredibly fully rendered, very accurately drawn, with a huge sense of, you know, it's very anchored in reality, I think. And for Lucifer, we needed something that was a little bit more fluid and fantastic and divorced from reality. And I think one of the things that Peter brought was that sort of sense of the numinous and the fantastic. Right from the start in House of Windowless Rooms, in that first arc, where you have Lucifer walking into the realms of pain, the Japanese afterlife, you really feel like you're leaving normal. that first arc has a cast of thousands. It has preposterous settings, you know, like a palace on the back of a living animal, which is like, kind of like a giant insect. It has this room through which the souls of the dead flow like water, and so on. And Peter just, he never flinched, he never batted an eyelid. He just gave me all that stuff, and he gave me more than I was smart enough to ask for. It came back transformed. And I just knew at that point, you know, this is the only guy for this book. And looking back now, you know, if Peter hadn't come on board, if Lucifer had gone ahead without him, you know, it might still have survived to the end of the run, but it would have been a very, very different, and I think a much poorer book.
I'll tell you what, Peter is. Peter is one of the nicest guys. I had an opportunity to meet him about 3 years ago, and a genuinely nice guy. I mean, you can't say a bad word about him.
Yeah, he's a stupendous guy. He really is. And, you know, and also a hugely gifted artist. And he's one of my favorite people to work with for both of those reasons. This is kind of jumping sideways a bit, but on Unwritten, whereas with Lucifer, he comes on board issue 5. You know, we've already had the miniseries and 4 issues of the monthly. And so he contributed storytelling ideas, but he kind of limited himself to interpretations of what I was already setting down. Whereas with Unwritten, because we developed it together, we pitched it together, we've worked it all out together. He's as active in the storytelling as I am, and it's a fantastic collaboration. It just brings out the best in both of us, I think.
How has your scripting changed with Peter? I mean, you've done so much work with him now. Do you kind of work in the old Lee, Ditko, Kirby Marvel style, or...?
It's not Marvel style. I can't go that far. I still like to have some control over pacing. But with Peter, I write much more elliptically. I leave stuff out. I basically say, the effect of this scene is this, so you can do it this way. Peter knows that he can ignore page breaks if he wants to. He can handle scenes in a different way. There's much more give and take. There's much more dialogue at every stage of the process with Peter. And I know that I don't have to, yeah, there are certain things I don't have to say that I can leave to him to decide.
I hadn't read any of the Lucifer or Sandman, even though my wife owns every single Sandman issue and copy and trade and absolute edition out there. I haven't read a single one yet. I need to get on that. But
You really do.
I know. But I was trying to not pay too much attention during the Lucifer conversation, just to not have anything ruined just in case. But I can jump in at the point where I was first familiar with your work. And that was right around the time I started reading comics again, and that was with Crossing Midnight.
Right.
Crossing Midnight is probably one of the first, because like I said, I started reading again probably back in about 2004. Crossing Midnight's probably the first non-superhero book I started reading after I started reading comics again. And it was also the book that told me that any book that came out that had your name on it, I was going to give a shot.
Cool.
Again, I don't really have a lot of questions other than tell you that it's awesome. And I really enjoyed reading it.
the Chris Farley show. Yeah.
One of the things I remember from reading it, it seemed at first like I don't remember it ending. And then I remember a few months ago going through my books and going, whatever happened at the end of Crossing Midnight? And I read it again, and it actually does have a pretty good ending. But I've heard other people say that it felt like it just kind of didn't have an ending. I think it all came down to people just wanting more.
To be the same sort of length as Lucifer, you know, mm-hmm. to sort of run through 6 or 7, maybe 8 years. That big war, the war between Komori Rinjin, the Shadow Dragon, mm-hmm. and Uratsu, that was always going to be our end point, but we were going to take our own sweet time getting there. We were going to build up, you know, major characters on both sides and have lots of double crosses and twists and you know, alliances and betrayals and so on, and finally get to that same point. But it would have been a much bigger payoff, and the war would have been played out at much greater length. So yeah, I guess there is a sense in which, you know, we were having to make the best of a bad job. You know, we needed to wrap it up, and we needed to wrap it up within a certain number of issues. So we tried to put in all of the beats that we wanted to have, but in a kind of truncated form.
So I guess with Crossing Midnight, what's the story behind that? You guys planned on going a lot longer with it?
Yeah, we were hoping that it would run for, you know, about 3 times that length.
Yeah,
it was always going to be you know, with a fixed end point. I guess whenever I pitch anything to Vertigo, mm-hmm. I assume that there'll be a fixed end point. So we'll be Unwritten. We know what the last beats are going to be. We know what the climax has to be. But it just, you know, Crossing Midnight never found its audience, really. I'm still not sure entirely why that was, you know, because by that time I was writing X-Men.
Yeah.
It got a lot of favorable coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, somehow, it couldn't find the numbers, it couldn't find the readership. And Paul Levitz gave us as much protection as he could because he liked the book. You know, so,
yeah.
So he let it run as long as he possibly could. But in the end, we had to sort of to throw in the towel and finish it.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things I've noticed, one of the big differences between Crossing Midnight and The Unwritten got much more aggressive promotion before the first issue came out, a long time before the first issue came out. You know, there was much more sort of detailed and concerted planning at DC as to how it was going to be launched, and they gave us a lot of latitude, a lot of leeway. For example, you know, doing the first issue at $1, giving us a double length first issue, sending out review copies to a whole lot of places, going into second printings for each of the first three issues and so on. They really bent over backwards to sort of give us the best launch they possibly could. And, you know, that all makes a huge difference because it just means that you're inevitably going to get, between issue one and issue four, you inevitably get that terrifying dip, you know, because stores order less, you know, they order fewer copies, and a lot of people will just pick up the first issue out of curiosity and then throw it aside and not think about it. So you get that dip, but if you're falling from a higher point, you can sustain that dip and survive, and then the numbers will come up again. If the book is worth reading,
right,
the numbers will come up again. But just being able to get over that hump means such a lot.
Yeah, I know at Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina, a couple years ago, DC had brought quite a few of the promo issues of different books, and Unwritten was one of them, and I was sure at the end of the convention to snag one of the leftover boxes of comics, which I give out to anybody and everybody who I think may have an interest in that book.
Right.
So
I appreciate you spreading the word.
And yeah, like you said, Unwritten, it had the had little preview lead-ins in the end of some of the Vertigo books, which Vertigo has been doing now a lot lately, which I think has been great for their newer titles.
Yeah, I that makes such a lot of sense because you're kind of preaching to the right audience, aren't you? I mean, these are people who are already inclined to buy books that have that kind of aesthetic, that kind of mood.
The Unwritten, I believe, is that on issue 19 now?
No, it's on issue 21, I think.
21. 20,
maybe 22, even. Possibly.
So, it, so
20,
it,
I think 20, 22 is out next week.
So it has surpassed Crossing Midnight.
Yep. Touch wood.
Yeah. And its issues. I've really, really been enjoying watching Unwritten unfold. And one of the cool things about it, and I'm assuming it's a lot about that Neil Gaiman Sandman writing that you guys were talking about earlier, but the thing that I loved about Crossing Midnight and the thing that I love about The Unwritten is as you watch these stories unfold, each chapter is almost like a new story. It's almost as though like the point, the direction of which you thought this book was going just becomes even huger than you could imagine. And that's one of the things I really, really enjoy about your writing style and about the books that you do. How big is Unwritten getting? I mean, it's the world just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and that will carry on happening. And it's good to hear you say that, because that is definitely how we sort of how we pitched it. You know, that this is a story that would like open up like Chinese boxes,
mm-hmm.
one box within another, and it would just keep on expanding and keep on sort of touching other stories in unexpected ways. And there's a sense in which the biggest twists, the biggest revelations are still to come. We don't really know exactly what Tom is yet. We don't know what Wilson's plan is. There's the whole of Wilson's backstory to come, which is a big focus in issue three, in year three, and so on. And then it ends, you know, the climax has got some spectacular reveals in it. So I think it will carry on surprising people. I hope it will carry on surprising people. Every so often, I'll read a review which will sort of take certain things for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll think, but you're wrong. It's not going there.
and that's what I love about it. And I think that's we all do that when we read your work. Is we all take things for granted that you in the very next issue or next story arc prove us wrong.
that's great to hear. No, but I'm having such fun with that book. I've never written a book like that before. I've never done anything which has been such a full collaboration with the artist. And in a way, it's scary, you know, because it's like each of us is straying onto terrain that we wouldn't normally
mm-hmm.
be comfortable on. And yet it seems to yield, you know, really, really good results for both of us. The characters, the way the characters of certain characters have sort of come to life in the writing. You know, so with Lizzie, for example, I had a conception of Lizzie, but she's in some ways she's escaped from that initial conception. She's become something different. I think something more interesting.
You were talking about how it's new terrain. This has to be a huge undertaking for you guys, because not only are you writing a story, I mean, you're doing blog entries and newspaper articles and chat sessions, and there's all sorts of different aspects of writing that you're bringing into almost every issue of this book. How wide of a writing palette does that take? I mean, do you really have to stop and switch between these different modes?
It's actually very time-consuming. I mean, the pages that you're referring to there, you know, the pages with all the internet stuff and the alternate media stuff, they take ages to script. They really do. And they take ages for Peter and his assistant, Bob Gutman, to put together. They're actually a huge challenge, and never more so than with issue 17. You know, the choose your own adventure story.
Mm-hmm.
That was just maddeningly difficult. It took about three times as long as a regular issue would take. But you know, it's fun. It's fun to sort of push yourself in those ways. And I think the last thing you want to do as a creator, I think, is to tell the same story endlessly. And I think it's an easy trap to fall into. You know, to sort of get into a groove. And then just do that thing again and again, because it's an easy thing for you. And I think with the unwritten, because it's both of us and because each of us has an equal stake in it, it's kind of like, you know, with a Ouija board, how everybody has their finger on it and nobody's sure who's moving it at a given time. It's a bit like that. You know, the story escapes from us, but not in a bad way, in good ways, in ways that sort of open up new possibilities.
You had mentioned issue 17, which is the mini lives of Lizzie Hexham. And I remember somebody telling me the new Unwritten is a choose your own adventure. And I remember thinking, well, that's pretty cool. That could be fun. And I read it, and I remember reading it, and I read it every way possible. I read it, and then I went back and I read it again, and I went back and read it again. And I must have been reading the book for hours. And I remember at the end going, yeah, that was pretty cool. That was a neat idea that he did there. And then the next morning, I woke up and just realized how brilliant of an idea and how complex it could have been. And mainly it became down to I was describing it to somebody. And I said, yeah, it's really cool because based on the choices that you make, it kind of defines the character for you. Like if you say he had, like, you know, good intentions, then, you know, when you get to the end, you're like, oh, well, that character's had good intentions this whole time. But then I kind of realized that it's not the book that's telling me how the characters are. It's the choices that I've made. It's what I've been reading for the previous 16 issues that has told me what I feel about this character. And it got kind of psychological on me, and it felt like I went through a session of therapy.
Exactly the starting point, you know. There were two starting points, because it was Pornsack who originally said, yeah, you ought to do a choose your own adventure sometime. Mm-hmm. And we both said that would be cool. And then we'd separately said, well, we got it sooner or later, we've got to do Lizzie's story. and then I realized, actually, that's the perfect way to do Lizzie's story, because she has all of these origins, if you like, these paths, which are mutually exclusive. And at the point when we tell her story, nobody's going to know for sure what's true and what isn't. And how cool would it be if we could tell all those different versions and make them all be true, or all be potentially true? So that was what we tried to do. And God, it just took off. Vertigo agreed to give us the 32 pages, and then I phoned Peter and I said, you know, 32 pages aren't going to be anything like enough to do this. We need, you know, how about if we have 64? And I suggested, you know, let's turn the pages sideways and turn each page into two. But of course, you know, Peter and Ryan just got the same page rate as normal, and they're effectively doing twice the work. And then, of course, there was the whole problem of putting it together, you know, weaving all the different narratives together. We must have run up phone bills of hundreds of dollars. Each of us with all the pages spread out across our floor, arguing, you know, this has to come before this. No, it doesn't, because this seeds this. And it drove us all crazy. But it was worth it, I think.
As much as it is a story, Lizzie's story, I think as far as a lot of defining characteristics, it really ends up defining Wilson's intentions and who he is.
I think that's when you realize just how, you know, how much of a how far Wilson has been controlling all of this. You know, mm-hmm. he's been orchestrating every single event, and we come back to that again in 25, 26. when Tom comes back from the Leviathan arc, we have this two-parter called Citizen Taylor, which is about Wilson's past, and we open up Wilson's past a little more and start revealing a few things about his agenda. Again, you just see actually this sort of control freakery, this manipulation of other characters. Actually, it goes back before Tom and Lizzie. He's been doing it for a long while.
I did get a chance to talk to Ryan Kelly at New York Comic Con, and he had some of the pages there, and he said that this was the most difficult project he's ever worked on.
I can believe that, yeah. But yeah, it's heartbreakingly good. You know, when you look at the art, when you look at what Peter and Ryan did, there's a sequence of pages toward the end, mm-hmm. which is where Tom is trying to wake Lizzie from her coma, and Tommy is trying to save Sue. Mm-hmm. It's trying to bring her back from the spell, restore her to life, and you're constantly intercutting between those two. And there's a couple of pages where it's not intercutting anymore, but the worlds kind of bleed into each other, and those moments are just held in parallel. It's wonderful art. It really is. It's the perfect rendition of that, those two parallel narratives.
I don't know if anybody listening has actually followed my advice and read this, or I know people have, but I don't know if you, particularly, who are listening to me right now, have read Unwritten, but you did just get to hear us talk about how awesome it is. Do you have a quick synopsis for those out there who haven't given it a chance yet, Mike?
For the Unwritten? Okay, well, it's a story about stories. It's a story about a young man who discovers that he may be a fictional character, that he may belong in a story rather than in the real world. He doesn't believe that. He believes that he is a real human being who has had an ordinary birth and an ordinary life. But the more he tries to prove that, the more it all falls apart on him and the more fictional he seems to be. Ultimately, it's about why stories are important to us, why stories matter in our lives. One of the characters in the first issue says stories are the only thing worth dying for. And then in an issue that's coming up, another character answers that with stories are the only thing worth living in. But it's kind of our love letter to stories, to the stories that matter to us. And it's an exploration of why we tell stories and why stories are important, how stories have affected the world.
You hear that? Go read it.
Well, let me ask you something. And I am back. Mike, you said that writing some of these issues has taken longer. How long did it take for you to write the Rudyard Kipling issue? Because when I read the first trade, now I don't read floppies anymore. I'm strictly a trade guy. Like you said earlier, I could never be sure that I was going to get the next issue because of the way the distributors here are in the U.S. So right. I've kind of moved straight to trades. How long did it take you to write, let's say, an issue like that, the Rudyard Kipling one? Because that's a lot more dense than a lot of the other story in the first trade.
Right. I mean, there was a lot of research that went into that issue. It only took the same time to write as a normal issue would be, which is it took me about one day to block it out and about 2 to 3 days to write the script. But the research took a lot longer. I was reading about Kipling for 2 or 3 months before that. Not just for that issue, it has to be said. Somebody bought me a book called Kipling's Imperial Life. It was a biography of Kipling, but focusing on his influence on the politics of his day rather than on the poetry and the stories. And then that was a side of his life that I knew very little about. And I found that book really fascinating. And I guess the idea for writing, for bringing him into the Unwritten, came from that. And then I picked up, I can't remember what it's called, but there's a book of his letters to his children. Letters that he wrote home to his children when he was on the road. And that really sort of brought home to me that the sort of personal tragedies in his life, you know, the loss of his daughter and then of his son, which becomes such a big part of the story, those were the catalysts. And that reading was going on for several months before I wrote the issue and sort of ultimately fed into the issue. So, lots of time on research. Didn't take longer to write than any other issue, but it took a lot longer to sort of get into the position where I could write it.
Why did you choose to end the first trade with that story? Because it seemed different than the rest of the story. Why did you end it that way?
I guess because it was a way of setting out our stall, really. You know, the first arc focuses entirely on Tom and on the question mm-hmm. of, you know, is Tom Tommy? What is Tom? Where did Tom come from? We wanted basically to open it up and to show actually this story is much, much bigger than that, and it touches on much more, you know, much wider and more fundamental issues than that. So the Kipling issue, when you suddenly realize, you know, the cabal that is now tormenting Tom had been out there for at least a century before that, and some of the same people who we're meeting in the present day were around back then. And you saw, and then they were approaching writers, and they had this sort of this sinister agenda, which includes Kipling and includes Mark Twain, includes the destruction of Oscar Wilde. It was just a way of saying, stick with us, because there's much more to say, there's much more to tell.
How many issues is The Unwritten supposed to run? Do you have a, do you know, at issue 60 we're done, or?
We're thinking, yeah, somewhere between 60 and 75. You know, we don't want to be more precise than that, because as with Lucifer, there will be some stories along the way, particularly, you know, the one-off issues. There's some of those things you just want to have the room to explore them and to play them out when they come up. But we're definitely thinking that there is an end point, and the end point, it's not going to run longer than Lucifer, but something around about that length.
Last question I have is, as far as The Unwritten, has there been anything so far that surprised you in the book that you really didn't, oh, wow, I didn't know I was going to write that. That was pretty good.
Yeah, there have been a number of things. In some ways, I'm reluctant to say what they are, because if I reveal which things have grown along the way, then people will be able to guess from that which bits of the core narrative. And then, in some ways, that then sort of suggests what the payoff might be.
Yeah.
But a number of the supporting characters have really come to life in the writing. Yeah, I mentioned this before. I had a view of Lizzie when I started writing it, and she's turned into something else. If you look at Lizzie in the first issue, she's kind of ninja girl. You know, she's wandering around, knocking people out with an inhaler filled with some kind of weird gas and so on. And she's moved away from that origin. You know, she's still very capable in a lot of situations, but we've seen much more of her other side, her vulnerabilities, her fears, this whole, you know, the liaison between her and Tom. And some of that, really, we were just going on instinct. We just, as we started to fill the character out, certain things felt right. And she's become a much more three-dimensional character in that process. There's a character we introduced recently, Roush, who wasn't part of the original plan. You know, we didn't pitch Roush, but we realized at a certain point that there was a hole in that particular shape. You know, that there was a need for a character who does exactly what she does. And so we created it to fill that role. So there's always a mixture of the stuff that you plan meticulously and carefully beforehand, and the stuff that you just wake up one morning and you think, holy God, that would be good. It would be good if we could do that. So you do it.
And here is where we will end you for the day. Nice solid cut there at the end of Unwritten. We're about to get into the Minx books along with some of Mike Carey's novels and some of the other stuff that he's got coming up. Real quick, just want to mention again to check out Westfield Comics at westfieldcomics.com. They also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/westfieldcomics. So if you're interested in giving them a look, that is westfieldcomics.com. We'll see you at the Dollar Bin Awards next week and part two of the Mike Carey interview the week after. Also, for any of you interested in Unwritten and haven't had a chance to read it, again, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, I have quite a few of the Unwritten comics out there. So if you're interested, go ahead and shoot me an email, adam@thedollarbin.net, and I will mail one of those off to you. I believe I said the same thing about Chance Metropolitan, and somebody did contact me. I can't remember if I actually mailed it out to you. I hope I did. If not, I hope you're still listening. Shoot me an email, and I'll get that out to you, along with a couple other things. Thanks for listening. Again, if you're interested in giving Unwritten a shot, I have number one that I can mail out to you. Just shoot me an email at adam@thedollarbin.net. Thanks for listening.